Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Bring a little sunshine indoors with the exciting new arrivals in store or online at harrycurry.com.
Chair Doigan and Chair, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
You say that what's going on up at the Giant's Causeway is disgraceful. What is going on? What I read, some people are, bizarrely, putting coins in cracks.
Absolutely, Joe. I couldn't believe it when I heard that. Now, I, as a tour guide, like I would be at the Giant's Causeway, you know, from time to time. Now, I haven't been up there this season yet. I'll be up there now in the next week or so, all right. But, you know, I was just shocked when I heard that such an act of destruction, you might say, was happening up there at a World Heritage Site. You know, that people were throwing coins into the columns or pushing them in. It just, to me, just didn't make sense that this was happening and that it was maybe being allowed to happen. Even worse, you know.
Well, and you're also upset about other things that happened at the Giant's Causeway.
Well, you see, this is it too. Now, I myself personally, I've often made comment, you know, with people there. Now, sometimes, as you can imagine, there can be hundreds of people in the tourist season, depends on, you know, the time. Like people climbing up on top of the columns and, oh, listen, some of them, you just say to yourself, if this continues, how long are they going to be there for?
But that's know, not, because, they're not dissuaded from doing that, are they?
Well, not, no. This is the thing up there. Now, again, it could be maybe shortage of staff because, again, as you know, it's part of the National Trust in Northern Ireland. Of course, they look after it up there. But the thing is that, you know, sometimes they don't have staff down there. Like, that's the thing, you know. They're at the visitor centre, of course, they are up along. And, yes, occasionally you might see, you know, maybe one or two, but certainly not enough for the number of people who visit that site. But, you know, to hear that they were putting coins, I mean, absolutely. I was absolutely shocked, I have to say.
But is it the same? Why do people throw coins in the Trevi Fountain? Why do people throw coins in the Garden of Remembrance? And I know it's not encouraged by long shot in Parnell Square. Have you any idea? What is the mythology behind that?
Well, I would think this is some kind of a fad that maybe started, Joe, at some stage. You know, it started and somebody, now, okay, the Trevi Fountain, I've been there, of course, and they throw them into the water and maybe they take them out. But, you know, compared to the Giant's Causeway, what I'm picking up from what I'm hearing is that they're shoving in coins into the basalt columns, you know, to the grooves on them. That's a totally different thing, because absolutely, and as I've read, you know, and as I've heard, that is causing major damage. And I hear they have to get in experts now at the Giant's Causeway to have these removed, you know,
because the metal. Just, and I take your point.
Absolutely,
the Giant's Causeway is millions of years old. It's not. Yeah. It's not made by human endeavour as the Trevi Fountain is.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. And that's the thing with them, you know, where you have, say, a national treasure like that. And, you know, another example of something there, much closer to home, Joan, you'll be very aware of this yourself, Molly Malone round there in Suffolk Street. Look what happened there. I mean, again, something happened. Somebody at some stage kind of thought, go over and give Molly a rub there and whatever. And suddenly this became a fashionable trend, you know, that people were doing it. And now, of course, the authorities have to take action there because, I don't know if you've been around there recently. I regularly pass there and you see now what has happened to Molly, you know, around there on Suffolk Street because of the constant, you know, human interaction there with the statue.
The wear and the tear, so to speak.
Absolutely.
I didn't know about the St. Kevin's Cross in Glendalough. What happens there?
Well, no, the same thing there, Joe. Are you familiar with it when you go into the monastic city? You know, as you make your way down towards St. Kevin's Kitchen, and on the left, there's a very, very tall, very, very old St. Kevin's Cross. And what used to be the trend there, definitely were people were encouraged to wrap their arms around the cross. And if you could join your fingers, you know, if you were able to do that and make a wish this kind of thing. And I do remember that many years ago myself, but certainly at this stage now, and I know with myself, as because I'm a member of the Approved Tourist Guides of Ireland, we're known as ACCI as well, you know, our training and awareness of all of this, like we would be very aware that you do not do things like this and you dissuade.
Because
that
you could damage the cross.
Absolutely. And, you know, as you say, you know, Ger, you said there a while ago, they're there and once they're gone, they're gone. And if people abuse them, now, not intentionally perhaps, but, you know, like anything, if people are, if they feel, oh, this is what we should do because everyone else is doing it.
If you put your arms around St. Kevin's Cross and you're wearing a heavy coat with baby zips or buttons or indeed metal buttons, you automatically are rubbing off the back of the cross with those foreign materials. Now, the locks phenomenon that nearly started in Dublin, but DCC clamped down on it, pardon the pun.
And that was another one down at the Hapenny Bridge, of course. Again, one of our most iconic bridges, like over 200 years old, Joe. And, you know, the materials for it came from my own county of Leitrim, from up there to Leavenhere, and that's where it came from, the iron to construct it. But like that, too, there was a few years back there, every time, every other day you went down and there were locks and all kinds of things attached to it. And I know Dublin City Council had to take action there. And to go down, and they were sending, you know, their people were going down maybe on a daily basis to remove and take them off because, again, like that, they would have destroyed, you know, the bridge over time if that was allowed to go unchecked, you know.
Stay with us, Joe at RT.ie, 51551 is the text number. Daniel Corley, Daniel is in the Rachrahan Visitor Centre in Tulsk in County Roscommon. Daniel, have you any? Can you enlighten me as to why people would put coins in the Giant's Causeway? What are they hoping for?
Hello, Joe. Thanks very much for speaking to me. I suppose the issue we have really, in many respects, is it might necessarily be coins in the case of the likes of Rathcrohan, and we don't necessarily have the same types of visitor numbers that you see up at the Giant's Causeway. But people have a certain fascination with, I suppose, leaving their mark in different places of heritage or natural heritage interest, and we see that ourselves in our own rural. It is the royal site for Connacht, the Rathcrohan, but it's a rural countryside today. But one site we have is just the cave at Owen na Gath, reputed to be a gate to the Irish otherworld and synonymous with Halloween. It has over the years of my touring there and bringing visitors there. Countless bags and bags and bags of items that you could take out of that site in terms of votives and things that people are leaving, and they could be from the most asinine things such as tea lights and tea candles through to jewellery. We've had boxing gloves found down in the cave, which would be modern. People have been noted to be, you know, lighting cigars, drinking alcohol, but through to, you know, certain practices that you could claim as some sort of misguided ritual value. You know, we've had to take butter and milk, and we've had to take oats and clean out oats that have been left down in the cave, which will.
And what are these supposed to be offerings to the gods, or?
Yeah, it looks to be the case in a sense that milk, butter, and oats have been noted, in unfortunately, to a degree, irregularity, and it's like as if they're attempting to provide some misguided offering back to the land or back to the gods and goddesses of the land, in a sense. And it ends up being our task then to have to try and tidy that up and make that space respectable when we are bringing visitors into the vicinity. And respecting the monument and the monument that's been there, you know, the cave is part natural, so it's thousands and thousands and thousands of years old. And then, you know, our ancestors decided to attach an entrance to it. But that extends even over the wider plain, like not just Owen na Gath Cave, but in some of the other sites of Rathcrohan, we've had to shoo off metal detectors because metal detecting is illegal without a license on an archaeological site in Ireland, thankfully.
Of course,
So we've had to apprehend and kind of force people off and give them a telling off, and sometimes that leads to antagonisation as well.
What reaction do you get?
It's never positive, but I mean, you have to stand your ground. I mean, at the end of the day, we're ourselves and our farming community are the custodians of Rathcrohan. We're very proud of that, and it's a case that you won't stand for misrespect to that. And I mean, if you've got people, we have a farming project, the Farm and Rathcrohan project out there, where we're tooling the farmers up to proactively manage their archaeology and mind it, the next generation. So the farmers out there are very, very passionate about making sure that they could be the first people to call us in terms of there's something that shouldn't be happening out there. Mm-hmm. Can we do something to deal with it? So it's a case that, look, we're not able to have the eyes on it 24/7. We're only a local community voluntary effort that we have in the visitor centre in Tulsk and Rathcrohan ourselves. But at the same time, we're very much a huge amount of respect for what's out there and what's allowed to survive to us. So to see any kind of tampering or damage of it, or be it unintentional or, you know, deliberate harm and everything in between, it's enraging, and it's something that we like to actively stamp out to the best of our ability, at least.
Now, is this, I presume, coach tours, and there are a lot of coach tours that go to Giant's Causeway. You know, I presume the tourists are advised on the coach, please do not do A, B, C, and D. Are they?
Oh, absolutely, they would be, and I mean, it's a case of if. I suppose it's down to the individual guide and the level of responsibility that they can put on it, or the comfort of being able to, you know, cajole a group of 40 or 50 people to say, look, this is a place that we need to respect. Look, you shouldn't have to say that. It's common sense. But in some cases, you know, people will just do stuff for the sake of it. And, you know, the boon of the Instagram photograph or the Instagrammable photograph of these sites, you know, if you haven't taken a photograph at them, well, then it's, you aren't there in a sense. You see a lot of that that goes on as well. And people put themselves into harm's way in order to get into the photograph. Exactly. Get into the photograph alongside, you know, kind of a monument that you have to manage and kind of carefully maneuver yourself to get into space for, you know, they could hurt themselves, they could hurt others, or they could misrepresent the landscape in equal measure. So there's a lot of things that you have to manage. I mean, at the end of the day, there's a very well done National Monument Service education and series of videos where they're advocating very strongly for three words: leave no trace.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a lot to ask. Like, I mean, these places have come down to us in some cases for thousands of years, and in the case of the Giant's Causeway, you know, 40, 50 million years. Like, you know, we want to be able to hand it down to the next generation in as good a state as we found it, in a sense. And at least that's the attitude that we should be looking for. But not everyone carries that, unfortunately.
But you mentioned, for example, night tea tree lights or the night lights or whatever, votive candles. But surely people do that in churches all the time. Isn't that part of our what we are, in some sense?
Certainly, but I mean, if you're finished with them, take them away with you. Even in a space like that cave that I'm talking about, I mean, it's a space that doesn't have you know, a great abundance of fresh air, of oxygen in it. So, I mean, the lighting of any kind of material in it is going to have a detrimental impact on people being able to access this one, because there's a creation of paucity of oxygen or a raising carbon dioxide. So, I mean, it's a case of do something simple. By all means, be down there. I mean, I've been party to any number of different rituals and different ways in which people engage at these sites. But leave nothing behind you, and don't want that might have some sort of a harmful effect on it. It's, you know, leave only your memories, and photographs is more than welcome. But nothing that could be left behind, you know, because it means that someone else has to go and hopefully not have to replace or repair something, or something has been lost to such a degree that is irreparable or irreplaceable. But even to the simple fact of, you shouldn't have to expect someone to pick up your own litter belonging to you because you feel there's an importance placed upon it. But in reality, it's just a kind of, you know, it's an error of judgment, we'll say. That's probably the best way to describe it, and being nice.
Well, funny enough, I want to go to Stephen McPhillamy, who's in Dingle. Stephen, good afternoon. What I was going to say was, you probably saw the report today where tourism numbers have dropped again in April. Which we're told is very worrying. But you think places like the Giant's Causeway are oversubscribed?
I do, Joe. Like, I travel to the Causeway most weeks there with groups. I travel as a tour guide all over Ireland. And I think the Causeway now does experience, or maybe you'd say suffer, from over-tourism. Like, when I went there 20 years ago, there would be maybe, you know, a handful of tourists, 20 or 30 people. Nowadays, on any average day, you're going to have 30 or 40 buses. Most of these big buses have 52 people on board, so you can do the sums there. And there's hundreds and hundreds of people in rental cars, because the new thing on social media these days is telling everybody that not to go on bus tours because you have more freedom to hire a car, and therefore there's thousands of rental cars out there. So, you know, with over-tourism, you're going to have a certain percentage of people who are going to do silly things. I've never actually saw these coins at the Causeway before, I have to confess. I never, ever noticed them. But when I saw this in the paper yesterday, I did go and have a wee look, and these coins certainly do look garish. They look damaging. I mean, it's not sustainable, and we have to stop it. Tour guides can help. We can tell our guests not to put coins at the causeway. We need to have some other solution. Maybe they'll put a hashtag on Rory McIlroy's shirt at the Open saying no coins at causeway or something. But it just needs to stop, certainly.
But to try and stop it is very difficult. But two, every single ad for Ireland, not just Northern Ireland, now has an image of the Giant's Causeway in it. Visit Giant's Causeway on Carrickaread or whatever. So on the one hand, the state is encouraging people to visit. You think there's too many visitors?
Well, too many visitors is a kind of a term I don't like to use, okay. But it's certainly, there's certainly a lot. I mean, well, hold on. Actually, when I'm there, I do think to myself, God, there's too many visitors.
Okay.
But it's, you know, for years we were crying out to try and get tourists, and now many of us are crying out that there's too many. So finding that balance is important. You know, tourists are, I think most tourists are inherently responsible people. But you'll always get a percentage who are clueless and reckless and both together. So if we sort of educate those people, and that's the important one. I think most people are responsible. You have to ask, why are they putting the coins there?
I'm baffled.
It's good luck or something.
Is it?
Yeah, you'd wonder. Well, there is a wishing chair at the causeway already. Doesn't work, by the way. But anyway, you can go and make a wish. I've never ever heard of this tradition of sticking coins at the causeway. But obviously, it's the reality because these coins are there and they're starting to expand, and there's photographic evidence of them. So I can't understand why people would do it. I never heard of that tradition. But obviously, we'll have to start an education campaign now, just saying, please stop sticking coins in the causeway.
But wasn't it? Well, again, let's just not go back. Chair, maybe you can help me here, or anyone of the three. But what was the Hansel coin we used to get when we were children? Was that not a good luck coin? We were given a good luck coin on our communion or something. What I'm trying to say is all this not rooted in religion and mythology, and even before organised religion, paganism or whatever.
But Joe, can I just come in there and
there
to the other two two people there, and certainly Rathcrohan I know very, very well, and as I say, the causeway, and I would certainly agree there that over tourism is a bit of an issue. But really, the responsibility is on the tourist guide or on the area, you know, to highlight to the people on, as you say, on the coach tours there, you know, the big large coach tours coming in. You know that there's responsibility, because if they're just let go off and nobody says anything to them and says, look, walk down there to the causeway, off you go, and, you know, enjoy and whatever you want to do, same thing, you know, and they're not told or made aware. See, this, I think, Joe, this is the issue, is the lack of awareness and people not telling them ahead, do you know what I mean, that... You know, that these are national monuments, like one-off, like, that, you know, millions of years old, the Giant's Causeway is. And places, and Rathcrohan, which is a wonderful place. I know not too many people, big tours go there the same as the causeway. But, you know, if people are not made aware of responsibility, social environment as well, and leave no trace, again, very, very important. If people aren't, and people just slip off the go, you know, willy-nilly, no one's checking anybody. You see, and as I gave you the example there, Molly Malone, Dublin, the same. Now they're taking action. They're taking action now because it has been highlighted.
Yeah, but I wonder what will, like, I think there's two attendants there from, or even one at most times, at the Molly Malone statue. Like, what reaction do they get if a gang of lads or a gang of lassies come up and say, well, we're going to get a photograph taken by sitting in the cart or putting her arm around her waist or whatever? Like, what sanction do they have?
Well, you see, this of course, is the issue, because this now has become a norm, dare I say it, or a habit, we'll say, in Dublin. And I see it particularly with very large groups of walking, huge groups, you see, around there at times. And this is all the trend, as you say, sitting up around her or whatever they're doing, up in the cart, up on top of her and all the rest. And I know the City Council did say that they might have to look at something like putting something around the statue, which will be, you know, a very unfortunate
thing. Which they had to do in the Pieta in St. Peter's, didn't they? In
they
the Basilica,
did,
yes. Because people were rubbing the feet of the Virgin. Yeah.
Yeah, and
it was a bronze foot. It was a statue.
Or whatever it was. And as far as I recall now, and I might be wrong here, but I think Oscar Wilde's grave in France as well, that they had to do the same. They had to put a glass kind of a wall around it or something for the very same thing. Very same.
Okay, Eimear Flanagan. Eimear knows you do, you're working with the National Trust, Eimear.
Yeah, my tourism business is Away We Walk. We run a guided 5-mile hike off the full UNESCO coastline, the cliffs from Dunseverick into the Stones.
Well done.
Pretty much every day of the year. Been doing that. We're in our 13th season. So we take people the long way and the wrong way to the Giant's Causeway.
How long has this coin phenomenon existed? Do you know?
I've always seen coins, especially just at the Giant's Gate there. So the cut that's been made so you can get from the Grand Causeway through to the next bay, the verticals there, because it's at those verticals that they've existed probably some time. I've never known there not to be coins. So I'm delighted that the National Trust are shining a light on it. Taking them away and trying to stop the custom off it. Now, in fairness, like, I've been there, I've never counted hundreds of times. I've never actively seen anyone putting a coin in between the rocks.
With knowledge of the human condition, have you any idea why? Why people? What do they think is going to happen? Or not happen?
I know, there's so many nationalities there as well. I think people don't know how international it is. So we're walking along the cliffs. There's farm fences the whole way. A number of years ago, near Hamilton Seat, there was like one little ribbon on a fence, and then there was two. And then by the time the season was done, the entire fence at the corner was covered in padlocks and ribbons. Yeah. That's all been taken away at some point, most likely by the National Trust. And there's been nothing since. So it's the first person, you know, it's the classic leave no trace, leave footprints, take photographs, and that's all you need. Now, in saying that, like, of all the, 13 years, I've once seen a young lad carrying a stone off the loose rocks from the main site up toward the visitor centre. So, and like, but prior to the site being managed, today it's looked after by the National Trust. It's been a UNESCO World Heritage Site, I think, since the mid-1980s. Like, the reason there's a bus turning circle down at the main site is we once built a cottage down there. You know, we protect it better today than we ever did before. Because we appreciate its heritage. My customers regularly ask me, when are they going to stop people climbing on these rocks? And I'm going to say, well, they're 65 million years old. That's probably not where the damage is coming from. And it is, you know, people's inclination I think it's different cultures, different customs. Some of the coins there would have been quite old. They've been there. They've built up over a long period of time.
But Eimear, have you ever? What about people climbing means people falling?
Yes, and that's what the staff are doing down there. I believe they significantly reduced the accident at the causeway on staff positioning alone, without having loads of signs all over the place.
Okay.
You know, when it's busy in peak season, they try to keep it as a UNESCO World Heritage Site, so they're trying not to be blowing their whistles. All their staff, most of us in activity tourism, will do first aid every couple of years. The National Trust staff will use their first aid. But there are accidents, of course. You've got Joe Public rock climbing in every type of footwear, effectively. And, you know, from that point of view, the attraction is it looks like a man-made stepping stone, so it is accessible. And yes, of course, there will be accidents, they do happen.
But doesn't Ger, maybe you can ask somebody, this is a phenomenon I've seen recently around Dublin, and I'm baffled by it. I saw the other morning in a complex of flats, apartments, it's a Dublin City Council apartment. When somebody dies, there's now, it seems to be a tradition in some parts of the city of the whole street putting up either wrapping ribbon around their gate or even putting balloons up. Does anyone else notice that? I know I'm a bit odd in the things I notice betimes. Well, is this a new phenomenon? It is. I never saw it. That the whole street would be... I don't want to use the word decorate because it's insulting to could be seen as insulting. But when someone dies on the street, the whole street feels they have to memorialise that person by putting something on their front gate or as the I saw was red ribbons. Now, I don't know if it was a funeral, but I thought it was red ribbons around the outer perimeter fence or railings of an apartment complex and just off Pierce Street in Dublin. And I'm baffled as to what is the purpose or what is the point, and who do people go out and buy them or whatever. But it's a new phenomenon. Jacinta Duffy, Jacinta.
Oh, how are you? You said my two names, your namesake here.
Yeah, Jay Duffy, go ahead. JD.
Yeah, that's right. No, just it's something that I've always thought about the statue, you know, Molly Malone. I mean, why was she sculpted like that in the first place? I think it's demeaning to her legacy.
In what way?
Well, her boobs hanging out of her dress. You know, it looks a bit cheap. It doesn't look right. And no wonder people are walking by and saying, you know, or feeling they'll have to touch the boobs. So I thought, would they not take her away and put her dress up a bit more over her cleavage?
Yeah, but women...
What do you think?
I know you're not saying this now, Jacinta. But like a woman, if a woman wishes to wear a low-cut blouse or whatever, that's her own business.
Oh, I know. I understand that completely. But if you
just
really
because Molly Malone has a, it's, I thought it was the clothing was of an era, and just because Molly Malone, and it's not that low, but just because Molly Malone in the sculpture now we're talking about an inanimate object, you say. What are you saying? We'd put a raincoat on Molly Malone and people won't rub our boobs.
No, I'm not saying that, Joe. But I mean, if you look at the statue, there's low and there's low. But her, she's literally down to you know what. She's popping out of it. And I just think that it should have been, the dress should have been sculpted a little bit above that. And I don't think you'd have the situation today where people... want to touch the statue, want to touch her boobs, you know?
Joe, can I come in for a sec there, just on that? I'm just listening to what that lady is saying.
Jacinta,
and
yeah.
To a degree, you know, that sculpture, of course, of Molly Malone was done by the late Jean Reinhardt,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And she's no sadly no longer with us. But I would have, I might be wrong here when she was maybe given the brief of whatever she was doing. But, you know, in Dublin, like Molly Malone is fondly known as the tart with the cart, like that's what she's known as. And maybe that was given and maybe that was. Now, I'm not saying it's right and I absolutely take on board what that lady is saying. Yes, absolutely, her dress. But you know what I mean? It was obviously sculpted in whatever brief was given when that was originally being done, you know, for whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to change it now, I don't know how you do it, you know. I'm not sure it's possible.
Or maybe the model was modelled on a real woman.
Maybe, yeah, possible.
And if that's the way the real woman looked, so be it.
I don't know. I never saw anything as low as that, Joe, really. Even I love history.
Jacinta, you have to get out more. You've never seen... Have you never been on Harcourt Street at 3 o'clock in the morning or Wexford Street?
No, I haven't.
And by the way, everyone in the main are having great fun.
Okay. Well, you're making me sound like a real party pooper.
I don't mean that.
I know what you mean, Joe, but I just thought, I don't know the real history of, you know, the dress code in that era.
Yeah.
But I just thought, you know, they wouldn't be rubbing her boobs so much if they were covered up a bit more. And I thought it was
calling all knitters, calling all knitters, male and female. Would somebody knit a polo neck for Molly Malone?
Joe, every time I'm on the radio with you, you always make me laugh. Honest to God, I'm so sad you're leaving.
I hope the laughing is deliberate. I've seen, I don't know whether you've seen it up in, it's elsewhere. There's a great festival on Dublin called the Fizz Fest up in Fizzborough. Ciara Considine, a great group of people organising. But one of the things I've noticed now, the bollard, you know, the metal bollards that you see to stop cars park, they now all have knitted outfits. Knitted. Hand-knitted outfits. It's the country gone mad. It's the country gone mad. So if we can cover the bollards, so to speak, with a knitted sleeve, surely we can get someone to knit something for Molly Malone. Any particular colour just into our style?
You know, I'd say the bronze. The bronze,
the matches.
But it was just that it's causing such controversy.
Yeah,
you know, you hear it on the radio over, you know, a couple of times. So I thought, well, look, just take the statue away and cover her up a bit. That's all I thought, you know.
Then you could argue, what's the harm rubbing the statue anyway? It is metal. It is an inanimate object, you know. Stephen, do you want to come in on Molly Malone?
Yeah, that's exactly the good point you just made there. It's the symbolism of touching the Molly Malone statue that's the problem. I mean, she's a sort of a darkish coloured statue with two big shiny parts because 3,000 people a week touch one certain part of her body. So that's the problem. It's the symbolism of that. That's not good, you know. So you'd want people to stop doing that. But I don't think it does the statue too much harm.
Yeah.
Whereas putting coins in the giant is long-term damage to a natural site.
So a beautiful natural phenomenon. John Keating's in Fairview in Dublin. John.
Hello, John. Hello.
Your Trevi Fountain. Tell us about Hong Kong.
Yeah, they have a large statue of Bruce Lee, and it's just a very simple rope, like the one you'd see at the cinema, just a red rope, four columns connected on, and nobody goes near the statue. There's just a little sign saying, please do not climb on the statue. That's the end of it. But in Ireland, why do people just seem, they don't seem to do what they're told or what they're asked to do?
Why is there a statue to Bruce Lee?
Well, he was born in Hong Kong.
Is this Bruce Lee, the film star? Is he a film star?
Yes.
There's a statue
Hong Kong.
To Bruce Lee?
Yes.
Okay.
The same as you have a statue to Phil Lynott.
Yeah, but Phil was a genius.
Yeah, well,
that's a brilliant
Bruce
statue.
Lee wasn't too far behind him.
Oh, was he not? Okay. Because I was saying earlier during the promo, I was talking to somebody yesterday reminding me, now it could be wrong, he said to me, tomorrow week is the 1944, June the 6th anniversary of D-Day, one of the biggest, if not the biggest military operation in world history. The recognised definitive history of that particular day is called The Longest Day. Stay with me now, bear with me. And it was written and it's translated 18, I think it was written in the 60s, 18 different languages, sold millions of copies. It's regarded by historians as the definitive. But it was written by a Dubliner, called Cornelius Ryan, who was born up in Hastebury Street, which for people from outside Dublin is near, not too far from Stephen's Green, I suppose. And somebody was pointing out, why is there no memorial or even a statue, John? If Bruce Lee can have a statue, Cornelius Ryan can have a statue. Okay, stay with us because we've got to take a quick break. Joe at RTE.ie.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Revamp your home this May with our fresh new curtain and bedding designs. Discover comfort and style for every room.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
So, a number of mysteries so far on today's programme. What did people think they were achieving by putting coins in the Giant's Causeway? What do people think they're achieving by wrapping themselves around St. Kevin's Cross and Glendalough? What do people think they're achieving by throwing coins into a fountain? And then the other mystery is, well, which I suspect, I think it's to do with funerals. Where has this tradition, I've seen it in Dublin now, not that often, where have we seen that tradition come from, where whole streets are seen to be decorated in some form or other around when someone dies in the community or in the, what is the significance of it? Just, I'm curious more than if anyone can. And then the other mystery is, why is there no memorial in Dublin to Cornelius Ryan, the man who wrote the greatest book, people's the greatest history book and the most successful history book around the Second World War. Anthony, why is he's not memorialised in Dublin at all, it seems. Anthony Murphy. Anthony, good afternoon.
Hiya, Joe.
Okay, your contribution, please.
Well, Joe, I'm a tour guide, okay. And I run Mythical Ireland. I've written books about Ireland's, particularly the megalithic heritage of Ireland,
okay,
and the prehistoric monuments. I've been bringing, mostly foreign, but a lot of Irish visitors around various monuments and sacred sites over the last 20 years or so. And in the past decade, and in particularly in the last 5 years, I personally have witnessed an increase in the number of incidents of vandalism at these monuments.
Okay.
And I mean, these are, when you talk about, you know, the likes of Newgrange, you're talking about, you know, Neolithic passage tombs that are over 5,000 years old. They're very precious.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's only 260 known passage tombs in Ireland. And then, unfortunately, you get idiots going up to, you know, fairly remotely located cairns on hilltops in the darkness of night, and doing things like scratching symbols on ancient stones, in some cases digging pits into cairns. I don't know, were they treasure hunting? You know,
you've
probably seen there were at least three attacks on the famous Lia Foyle, the Stone of Destiny at the Hill of Tara over the past 10 or 12 years. And it leaves us all bewildered because we're wondering what gets into the minds of these people, and do they not realise that, well, first of all, what they're dealing with is very precious, that secondly, they're committing a crime, and thirdly, and most importantly, in some cases, they're actually causing restricted access for everyone else as a result of their activities.
Yeah, and that's why, as we know, access to Newgrange is rightly so, very, very properly policed, so to speak. And Anthony, say this with a minute, because we might have solved one of the mysteries I've been asking you about today, the practice of putting ribbons and balloons on gates and houses around funeral times. Marion Hopkins. Marion, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
You can solve this for me. Tell me.
Well, yeah, well, one of the reasons recently was during COVID, we couldn't attend any funerals of our neighbours or even friends.
Okay.
So the community kind of thought of some way. We initially went out and as the hearse passed by where the person used to live, we'd just stand all in a line along the avenue, kind of clapping.
Yeah, I remember
you know,
that.
In respect, yeah. So then we, one of our neighbours, a couple of them actually got together and they said, look, we'll do a little thing like balloons, and it started with balloons. Then it started with the coloured ribbon tape coming from down to the railing from either a window or whatever. If it was a person's favourite colour, we'd try and find that out and use their colour, yeah.
Or and if it was a Marina, football team. Are you saying, what part of Dublin or Ireland are you in?
In Finglas.
And do you believe you started this tradition?
Oh, I didn't. No, I didn't. A neighbour did. No,
that's what I mean.
Did.
Yeah, where do you believe it started?
Well, at the time, we couldn't travel very far. We were limited to 2K, so I really couldn't say. But I think we kind of probably... Now, there could be other communities that claim they were first or ever, but we didn't see it anywhere else because we weren't allowed to travel. So we only knew of it happening in our own particular area.
Okay, so we can... And it is an act of solidarity, an act of community... And you believe that it started in Finglas in Dublin during COVID?
During COVID, definitely.
That's a world exclusive. Because I've seen it around. Now I've seen it especially in working class areas. And then the one I saw the other day it was a railing surrounding a big, beautiful complex in the centre of Dublin. But the ribbons, they weren't loose ribbons. They were bought ribbons. They were little ribbon bouquets. So was somebody now selling these for funerals?
Oh, gosh, I couldn't say that. Yeah. Now, one of our neighbours, Johnny up the road, and Caroline and a few of them, they used to actually go and source a reel of ribbon.
Okay.
They'd buy the whole reel or few reels it used to take because, and you would actually, it's like a streamer and you tie it to either your top window, wherever you could secure it to, and to a gate or railing okay. down at the footpath. You know, you have to kind of secure it because it'd be up for maybe a couple of days and sometimes the wind used to get the better of it. But we actually kept it going, I'd say, until earlier this year.
But I saw it this week.
Yeah, well, it could be. I suppose it could be.
Spreading
it.
You know what you've started, Marion.
Well, I didn't personally.
Well, whoever that person is in Finglas started. I was in the middle of COVID.
Yeah,
when people,
early on.
Yeah,
I'd say it was early on.
Yeah, in one sense, it's fantastic that people saw a way of expressing, and they'd find out if the deceased had a particular colour that they liked.
Yeah, or followed the team or
their team.
Whatever.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
and whatever.
It started. Do you remember when we used to go out at 8 o'clock in the evening to applaud the frontline workers?
Yes, yes.
And so then it kind of people said, okay, well, we have to mark. As a mark of respect for someone maybe in the locality that actually passed away and we couldn't pay our respects, we couldn't go to the family, we couldn't go to the church. And so we used to just line the avenue with them people and we just clapped the hearse as it went by.
Yeah.
So it started like that. And then the ribbon and balloons, I think the balloons started first and then we found the ribbon was a handier thing to organise, and we'd all bounce in and buy the ribbon.
Okay.
And
there was
a couple of neighbours, Johnny and Caroline and all them, that did the hard work, I have to say. They did all the hard work.
But you're clear, Marion, I won't hold you to this, but you're clear that when the idea started up in Finglas in what, 2020, 2021 during COVID?
2020.
You weren't copying it for someone. Someone had this original idea to put up a ribbon or a tape on the whole street to show as a sign of solidarity with the deceased family.
Yeah,
excellent.
As a mark of respect, yeah.
So in thousands of years from now, Marion, remember, the Giant's Causeway
is on Google Maps.
Yeah, and with thousands of years, people, historians, whatever they are, ChatGPT, there'll be no humans anymore, we'll all be robots. And they're saying, does anyone know where this incredible phenomenon started of people putting ribbons and balloons around a community went in solidarity with someone who dies? And they say, you have to go back to 2020, back in Dublin in 2020. Okay, say well done, Marion. Well done. That solves that mystery. I had someone else there about to solve the Molly Malone mystery, but we'll try and get it back after the break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
There's a great ad there. You've heard it so many times for the National Day of Creativity, especially among young people. Invent something or just do something, to write something, draw something, paint something that is completely meaningless once you enjoy doing it, which is fantastic. But the other thing I mentioned earlier was, did you know that in the early 1970s in Ireland, an Irish locksmith called James Williams, he invented a key, okay? Bear with me now. He invented a key, a universal key that could be used in every wheelchair-accessible toilet. Do you follow me? So everyone who needed an accessible toilet, they were given one of these keys, and it was generated, because apparently that's how you make a key, it was generated by, he's passed away now, I'm told, by James Williams in 1970, and his family shop is a well-known, brilliant shop up there at the top of Ainger Street, near Hastery Street, Cornelius Ryan. But that this man invented, generated this special key. His name is on a JW, obviously, for James Williams. It's called the JW407 Abloy. And I bet you never heard of that. And that's the type of programme it is today. Where's Anne Baker?
Hello, Joe.
Hi.
I'm very well.
Yes, good. Jan Reinhardt was your mother's cousin.
She was, yeah.
Yeah, and can you enlighten Jacinta, who's still on the line there, about why she is dressed in that particular way, Anne?
Well, typical of the time, they didn't have prams or buggies.
Okay.
So the babies were carried everywhere under shawls.
Ah.
And it was ease of access to feed the babies. They could just pull the dress down to feed the babies as they were walking or working. And that particular cleavage I get very insulted when someone feels it, because it was modelled according to Barry, her son, on her own cleavage.
Yeah, I remember it was years ago we did this before, and I know it was brought up again recently. Yeah, but it was modelled.
Yeah. Yeah, and the hands are actually cast of Barry's hands.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, let's put
that's why she was dressed historically.
Okay. Jacinta.
Yeah.
Stop knitting there for a minute. Come back to me. Stop knitting the polo neck. Are you convinced? What do you think of that explanation?
Well, I mean, she could have had it a bit higher.
Okay.
It was the fashion of the time.
Well, to allow easy access for the child.
Something now I never heard before.
Yeah, that's interesting. Anna Fitzpatrick. No, Anna has another angle. Stay with us. Joe at RTE.ie. Anna, you don't...
Hi, Joe.
By the way, was Monty Malone... It's based on a real character, the song in Dublin's Fair City, where the...
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I mean, this sculpture, as it's done now, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful sculpture.
Yeah, yeah.
But to be honest now, my idea of Molly Malone, in fact, I remember seeing a little kind of statue done of Molly Malone long before that big one was done, which is beautiful. And it was kind of she was wearing kind of a little coat with the collar up to her neck. And to be quite honest, Joe, I would doubt very much in that time. I can appreciate now what the other lady is saying, that it was for convenience or breastfeeding.
Yeah.
But she wouldn't have gone around, in my opinion, for what it's worth, she wouldn't have gone around with her boobs hanging out, because it would have been very much frowned upon. Even if she was breastfeeding, she'd been expected to keep her shawl around her until she was feeding the baby. Because given the church's influence then, there would have been a priest out with a stick beating lumps out of her to cover herself up.
But maybe, is there a clue with the song? She died of a fever and no one could save her. Is that because, and that began with a little catch, as Fluter says in the play. You got a little catch in your chest and it spread. Mm. And if she had been wearing a shawl, maybe she wouldn't have got the catch in her chest.
In my opinion, though, she would have been wearing a shawl. Like, you know, breastfeeding, she wouldn't have to go around with her boobs hanging out all the time. And she'd have had the shawl, and it would have been, actually, the shawl, I can tell you, would have been wrapped around to her back and tied at the back.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, they tied them at the back. And Anne Baker, how do you react to that? That the low cut.
Well, the low cut was the fashion as well.
Okay.
Just, if you look back in all the years, you look through, but it's with working women, the idea of them wearing those dresses was. They had
access.
No one to mind their children.
For the nursing child, yes.
Yeah. And it was just the style that she saw, and she obviously left the shawl off her, but that was actually the style of dress.
Okay. Okay.
You're probably right, but I wouldn't have thought that at the time. I really wouldn't. Because there would have been a lot of church influence, and you might have got that kind of thing up in Monto, where those poor unfortunate women had to sell themselves. But not a fishmonger walking around Dublin trying to sell her fish.
Okay.
But that's just my opinion.
It's your theory.
Yeah.
No,
we all have our own ideas.
Yeah, we're close to solving the mystery. Okay, yeah. Anna Fitzpatrick, Anne Baker. Thanks, indeed. And by the way, Monty Malone never existed, did she? No, she didn't.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Anne Lynch is back. Anne, how people are looking for an update on the dog with nine lives rally. The dog that jumped off the cliff and hold. How was he?
He's doing well, Joe. Thank you. He's really recovering nicely.
And we were looking for the rescuers, Anne. Jeff Doherty. Jeff, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Say hello to Anne Lynch.
Hi, Anne. Nice to talk to you again.
And Tommy Daly.
Hi, Jeff.
And Tommy Daly is there as well. Tommy, how are you?
How are you, Joe? How are you, Anne?
And you know you saved a dog's life, Tommy.
Well, that was Jeff did that. It wasn't me. No.
Okay,
Joe.
Jeff. Okay, Jeff, tell us what happened on that fateful Sunday.
Myself, Tommy and Damien and Sarah, we were out on a paddle with a group. We were a group the Cormorant kayakers. So we get together and paddle, and we were out for a paddle, and we could see some people hailing us from the shoreline.
Okay.
Part of saying hello at first, but we could see they were hailing us in, and we realised there was something amiss as we got closer. Anne and her friends were shouting to us, could we see a dog that had fallen? We couldn't until we got quite close. And at that point, I could see a dog not moving in between some of the rock pools.
Okay.
So I jumped out of the kayak, Tommy Helmer kayak, and we went in. I went in, and I could see Raleigh was lying motionless, but conscious, a bit of blood around his face, and he looked like he'd had quite a fall. I think it would have been about 60 feet. He'd fell from. So able to lift him up and tell Anne and her friends that he was alive. He would need to get a vet. So we gave them the heads up to get a vet, and that we would try and meet them down the coast, because there was no way of getting them back up the cliff.
Of course.
Meet them down the coast at the dinghy club, at which point then I handed the dog over to Tommy to put on his lap, and we paddled with haste down the coastline to meet Anne and her friends.
And Jeff, the blood, I didn't know there was blood. Do you reckon that Raleigh hit rocks on the way down?
Almost definitely, yeah. And I'd say it was a hard landing for him. I was delighted to hear yesterday or the day before that he had survived. Really was good news, because he looked like he had
He was in a bad way.
He was totally in shock. No movement, really.
Because he's only a small dog, isn't he, Anne? He's a Pomeranian. What weight would Raleigh be?
He weighs about 10, 11 pounds. 10 or 11 pounds, maybe 5 kg.
5 kilos? Wow. He really is lucky. Tommy, what's your memory of this incredible rescue, Tommy? Well done. Have you done it before? Have you done it before, by the way, Tommy?
Well, one of the lads have, yeah. Damien, we've rescued a few horse and a pike and a few bits and pieces.
A horse?
As you come along them on the river, you know, that's on the Liffey.
Okay.
Jeff just did all the hard work. I didn't know whether a dog in shock could take the hand off you, you know, so... He placed him into my kayak. I just slipped off the spray deck, and the dog was very placid, very quiet, mm-hmm. and he started to come around. And I just engaged him in conversation to keep him conscious, and we got him back, and that was it. But Jeff says, we didn't know. I was delighted to hear
that he was alive.
He survived, because we didn't know what the outcome was at all.
But he fell off a block of flats, didn't he?
Absolutely.
The height.
I'm from the top balcony of a block of flats, Joe, and I'd say he fell off higher than the top balcony of a block of flats. Some fall. It's amazing that he's alive.
Yeah. Well done, and fair play. Who rescued the horse?
I think it was the fire brigade in the end. He just couldn't get out of the Liffey. But I got a picture of him the next day. It was late at night, actually. We were on an evening paddle, and it got dark with the horse. But he had a bit of form. He'd been stuck in the river a few times.
Probably didn't want to go to France.
exactly.
And what lads or whatever groups, lassies, whatever, coming along the Liffey in kayaks, and they saw a horse that could not be seen from the road. Is that it? And you reported it.
In behind the Italian ambassador's residence, in behind Lucan Village.
There's land
the other side of the river, which nobody can see, only the kayakers or somebody on the river. So when we were finished, we couldn't get him out of the river. So when we finished our paddle, we went back around to, there's a couple of houses on that land. So we alerted the person living in the house and they got in touch with the horse owner, you know.
I know Raleigh is what age is he now, on 4 or 5, but I think he should change his name to Lucky.
I don't disagree. No. I think that is a small miracle. There were many miracles that day.
Well done, Tommy. Tommy and Jeff. By the way, I presume at some stage. I presume, but I hope not. Have you helped swimmers, Jeff or Tommy?
Yeah, we were out one day paddling back around Howth Head towards diving boards, just near the beginning of the walk, and one of the kayakers, Cormac, we could see this swimmer hadn't made much progress.
Wow.
She was in the tide was racing.
Yeah.
So as he approached her to see if she was all right, she latched onto the kayak.
And, oh, wow.
You know, was quite grateful. We just brought her back into the shore. But she was a capable swimmer, but she just got herself caught in.
Can happen so easily. So easily. Okay, we don't know what to give you, but there are tickets. You can choose two each, by the way. A pair of tickets each, either to the Water Boys, the Cars, Noah Kahan, or Neil Young and Van Morrison. Any preference there?
Thank you very much.
The Cars are the Cars have been on tour for about a year. It apparently is the most incredible concert you've seen, and it's touring all over the world. And where are they playing? Playing St. Anne's Park, actually. And it's apparently a brilliant, brilliant concert. They've just such a slew of hits. Neil Young is...
On a recommendation like that, Joe, I'll take. Yeah,
yeah, you want the Cars. Okay. What about you, Tommy? Neil Young, Noah Kahan, or maybe even, would this not be more appropriate, the Water Boys?
The Water Boys would be great,
okay.
Joe.
Brilliant, another brilliant band. Okay, Tommy, Jeff, Anne Lynch. You there, Anne? Do you want to go and see Neil Young? I know he's a Canadian. He's not American. He's Canadian. Do you want the Neil Young tickets? Sorry, you're breaking up there. Come back to me.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay. Neil Young and Van Morrison. What more could one want? Remember.
Those are classics.
Great. Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. Neil Young, you're going to Neil Young. Now, remember, though it did happen, and I saw it at a Leonard Cohen concert up in the Royal Hospital, Kilmainham, and this is a true story. A man was out walking his dog in Kilmainham, and suddenly this car came to a sudden halt, and he said, out the window, do you like Leonard Cohen? And the man said, I love him. He said, there's two tickets. I'm driving to the Coombe with my wife. She's about to give birth. The man walked up to the gate of the Royal Hospital Kilmainham with two tickets, one for him and one for his dog, right? The attendant on the gate said, there's no dogs allowed. He said, I have a ticket for him. And there's nothing on the ticket saying I cannot bring in a dog once I have a ticket for him. And for the whole concert, the man sat beside the dog in wonderment, as we all were, God rest him, at Leonard Cohen. But I don't think you can bring your dog to Matterhide Castle, Anne. So Silver are lucky, as he's known, should be saying. Well done to the Cormorant Canoeing Club. Canoeing Club. Jeff Doherty, Tommy Daly and all the other lads and lassies. Well done. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
I mentioned earlier James Williams inventing in 1970 a key, generating a special key which could be used universally in wheelchair accessible toilets, or disabled accessible toilets, which is a brilliant idea, a brilliant idea. I'm wondering why there's no plaque on the shop where he invented it. There should be, because I mentioned Cornelius Ryan around the corner, longest day. There's no plaque where he was born either, and we love all that stuff in Dublin. Now, Oliver Dillon. Oliver, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
Good. You say you know about this wonderful key, but there is
I have one.
Can you describe it to me? It's obviously unique.
It's a barrel shape. It's like a barrel. It's like a nail shape with special grooves in it.
Wow.
And it's very, very difficult, which is good, to be copied. People have tried to copy it. People have tried it, but it doesn't work as easy as that. But one of the places that I would use on a frequent basis is Condley Station.
Okay.
Condley has it. But the facilities in Condley for a handicapped person are brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Brilliant. Great.
But you move on to Western Row Station.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
They had it. Then they had their toilets upgraded.
Ah.
and they took that system out.
Ah, no.
Yeah, which means that you've got to get an attendant to get a key to open the toilet.
But that was the genius of James Williams' invention.
Yeah.
In Dublin in 1970, he invented this key you say is unique that would could only be given and accessed by through organisations or whatever to people who would use these toilet facilities. So the key was a simple way. You didn't have to go looking for an attendant. You didn't have to.
No.
And you could. It's easy to carry on your key ring, is it? It's not too big.
No. Okay. And the key ring alone is quite a neat key ring. If you've seen one, you'd say, right, like, you know, it explains on it with it in any case. But the other factor is toilets are getting upgraded that might have that system in it.
Yeah.
And they're not using that system.
Ah.
Right, which is a pity in any case. But I was out in America back in 07. Now, back in 07, I went out to stay with my sister out beyond Colorado.
Okay.
And she brought me to the mall, one of the big shopping malls in it. And I happened to go into a wheelchair toilet. And I was quite surprised to see the bar was actually out there for the key.
Okay.
I was it took me back. Like I said, I thought that was only unique around Ireland and maybe the UK and that.
It's not
incredible. I couldn't
believe
that it had gone that far. But the lock is there. It's handy.
Yeah.
Now,
Irish Rail, this Irish Rail, currently a Pier station, which is staffed full time, can provide access.
That's a beginning.
Staff and Pier station could be doing something else as well, you know.
Yeah,
the
having
key,
a break.
The key
stuff,
to me, the metal, simple key. What a simple solution. Now, Aon Road Air are saying we're going to reduce remote electronic access, which will allow staff and members. That's wrong. I was in Spain. I told people this the day of the blackout. Everything depended on electricity. Everything.
That's right.
You couldn't get into your apartment. You couldn't get into a lift. You couldn't get into a supermarket. Anywhere you needed a fob. So now, if the electricity goes, God forbid, and we're told today it will be the way we're using it. If the electricity goes, that means nobody can get into that wheelchair accessible toilet. But if we kept a simple key invented by this genius, James Williams, in Dublin 55 years ago. It's a simple system.
System. And another thing with it is, a lot of the I have a high-powered wheelchair, electric wheelchair.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
The toilets that are, the old toilets are not suitable. The old disability toilets are not suitable for a powered wheelchair because they're bigger. So they are. They're much, much bigger and they're more robust.
Okay.
When you have the toilet and you see the size, it's signed off. It has the width and the size. But then things are added into the toilet, like waste baskets and stuff like that.
Yeah, okay.
So that's closing the things. Some of the toilets that I would be able to go into with the key, it doesn't mean I can turn around to go back out.
Oh, I know what you mean,
You know, because they're not being upgraded. They're not being upgraded right. They are going by old specifications,
okay.
Right, with them. And what needs to be done there to make it more easier, not just for wheelchair people. The toilet isn't just for wheelchair people.
Exactly.
People can go in with that need to change their children, diapers and stuff like that. It's a bigger item with them in any case. So they need to just rebuild a tin plate one. Get wheelchair people to try just turning around in it and where the stuff is. And they say, right, that is the right size. So it is with it. And this is what we legally will roll out, that it has to be within this size.
It's not rocket science.
No. Now, the third problem with them is, when if you come to my house, you'll have a toilet that's higher than the toilet that you can buy.
Okay.
It's for handicapped people. In other words, if you have a hip replacement, you'll get off it easier.
Oh, I know what you mean. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, of course.
So with a wheelchair person whose lower body can't move. I can't move my legs. Okay. I have polio. So I can't. The lower part of it in it.
Yeah.
But when I go to get onto a toilet, and this goes for the females would be more than me, they need to go, they would go, they have to lower themselves down. Now, they lower themselves down. If you don't have enough of power as you get older to pull yourself back up, it comes a bloody bit of a headache.
Okay, okay. Well, the key is called... That's well explained. It's well explained. By the way, the key is called... it's as I say, JW407 Abloy Universal Toilet Key.
Yeah,
you can get them. You can they're still being made, and thankfully, from J. Williams Locksmiths, 8 Whitefriars, Angel Street in Dublin,
there
near Stephen's Green. The key costs, they have a good online presence. They're on Twitter as well. The key costs €20 and can be sent by registered post for an extra 14 or 15 quid.
Yeah,
and obviously, people who are genuinely need it are the people who are genuinely. Apply it. Well done, Oliver. Thanks, Oliver.
Yeah.
Let me go to Christine Dunn before I finish. Thanks, Oliver. Christine.
Okay. Right. Thank you.
Hi, Joe.
Did you start this tradition of the ribbons and the balloons at funerals?
No, I didn't start it, but I was really, really appreciative of it. My father died in Fingerbus, June 2020, in the thick of COVID. Obviously, he'd lived in his house for 60 years. I was born in the house. We couldn't have, all we could have was the hearse, no funeral cars, very limited,
with
big family.
Very few people in the church.
And so, so he was one of the oldest people left on the street alive, because obviously his friends and all that had passed. But the neighbours that grew up with him, like people my age, they all arranged for ribbons, balloons. And they actually asked for his favourite ballads.
Okay, which is...
And when we went up... Yeah, so when we went up from this church up to the street, before we went down to the cemetery, they were all out in the gardens.
Okay.
The funeral directors told us, we wouldn't be there long, but we actually had to stay about 15 minutes because there were so many people in the gardens.
Oh, brilliant. And they were either had their gardens decorated in solidarity with your late father... and then they were playing music as well in honour of him. That's Barry Park in Fingers. We reckon now that's where this worldwide tradition started, and that you say you experienced it during COVID in June 2020. So that's it's only 4 years old, but it's catching on. Thanks indeed, Christine, and condolences on the passing of your dad.